Committee on Health and Human Services to order. And Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended and reconsideration of House Bill 2153 be taken up immediately. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The Chair requests unanimous consent that the motion on House Bill 2153 do pass and rescind the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be reconsidered. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2153 be referred with a do pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2153 with a do pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Yes.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And why was this?
We thought it did not need to go to Ways and Means. There was a disagreement on that, so we're sending it to Ways and Means.
Okay, so they think that someone thinks that it's going to cost money? Or someone doesn't like it.
This was a case of the chair getting ahead of himself and making assumptions. I assumed on reading the bill that it did not go to Ways and Means. The Speaker's office did not want to rescind the referral, so we are going to send it down there. I mean, we have two choices, either send it to Ways and Means or let it die. I want to send it to Ways and Means.
Okay.
Did you have a...
Gotcha.
Well,
that's what I needed to know.
I was just going to say, I don't think this is a comment or judgment on the bill by the Speaker's office. I just think the Speaker is correctly very concerned about fiscal matters, balancing the budget, and this is very consistent with her policies for the whole session.
Okay. And the chair takes full responsibility for making an assumption ahead of time, and I should have checked on that before I did what I did. So I apologize to the committee, and now we're just correcting an error.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Hearing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Dalto.
Excused.
Representative
Montanus.
No.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Westland.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2153, having received the required majority, is declared passed. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2153. Yeah, I think so. And I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2631. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. House Bill 2631 is changing current statute to allow that clinical laboratories or anybody conducting lab reports or laboratory results will be allowed to give those reports or results directly to the patients. We have a -1 amendment that we spoke to back in March. That is incorporated in the -2 amendments. The -2 amendment was in response to the Clinical Laboratory Association requesting that we incorporate similar language to CLIA, which is their federal association, which that is done in Section 2. You also have a -3 amendment that was submitted by the Oregon Medical Association that places an exception that the physician still has the option to indicate if a lab can issue, authorizing the lab issuing the result directly to the patient. The one is combined in the two, and the three is a separate amendment.
Okay, Representative Jensen, would you like to speak to the bill or to the amendments, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bob Jensen, state representative from House District 58, which entails the metropolitan areas of Hermiston and Pendleton and the surrounding smaller cities in Umatilla County. In relationship to the amendments that you have before you, I would still oppose the dash three amendments, basically on the same grounds that we talked about in the work session that you had, that we had on it previously. I have no objection to part A of the dash three amendments, but I do believe that the issue concerned that the Oregon Medical Association is interested or concerned about there is also covered with, I think it's the dash one amendment where we have inserted an and in there to ensure that the prescribing physician will have the same access to the tests that they currently have, so that there's no danger that the prescribing physician is not in the loop on this. The second part of the dash three amendments, and I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but I don't have them in front of me. It's really just kind of they're really just kind of two parts to it. The second part of the dash three amendments fails to get at the intent of the
Right behind you.
Okay, Tim, could you come up while you're reading them, Representative? Maybe we'll have Tim explain what he was getting at with the three, and then we can have further discussion.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. As the committee may recall, you asked the OMA to try to work with Representative Jensen to see if we could come up with some middle ground on these on this bill. We did that. Unfortunately, we were not able to reach agreement on the dash three amendments. And what we're after there is the opportunity to, in certain cases, be able to ask the lab not to release it directly to the patient first, but to have the patient come into the physician's office. And the examples that we used on that before would be cancer, HIV, pregnancy, those type of things. We think that's reasonable. We do in the amendment also make it clear that it's up to the community standard. So if the community standard is different in Pendleton than in Portland, you know, that would be taken into consideration. But we think these are reasonable and would give the Representative Jensen pretty much what he's after, just not in every case.
And fundamentally that is the thing that we were objecting to originally with the original statute, that there really is fundamentally no change in this, that it does, the potential is still there to deny the patient from the immediate access per their request to that information. And we talked a little bit, you know, about this. Not everybody has kind of easy access to their prescribing physicians, to the physicians. Sometimes there's considerable delay involved in getting that. And I'm, you know, I can't speak of what happens in the metropolitan areas because I don't live in the metropolitan areas, but my suspicion is that it's much the same. Individuals may there find it inconvenient, too awkward, too impossible. It certainly doesn't take into consideration the possibilities that the individuals are going to be out of town on a trip, on a vacation, with some need or act to have that, if for no other reason, just for them, just for their own personal knowledge about what their health care conditions are. In relationship to the issues in question as far as physicians having the first the general position presented, if I'm recalling correctly, on the part of the Oregon Medical Association is that people aren't smart enough or well enough in control of their own emotions or whatever it might be to be able to handle this sensitive information. As we're all aware, there are only about umpteen pregnancy test kits that you can get in pharmacies, you know, around the state. So anybody does not have to have access to a doctor to, or does not have to have a prescribing physician to have some sort of tests on that. I'm not speaking in any way to the reliability of those tests. The more reliable they are, of course, the less concern there would be. It's just simply that those tests are there and people will draw conclusions from them when they use them. The same thing, of course, is true for much of the other information that's talked about. There are on the internet a whole variety of tests that you can get for various and sundry quote-unquote sensitive issues, from prostate cancer on to HIV and so forth. Those tests are available directly then to the patient with no referral to a physician. I think the statement was made, and you'd have to check your records on this, but I think the statement was made that all of those tests go, results from the internet on these sensitive issues go directly to, not to the individual, but are referred to some type of a prescribing or some type of physician. Some counseling or that type of thing. This is not, in fact, what I found when I went to the internet. I find that test results are available immediately, not immediately, maybe a 2 or 3 day lag from when the information gets back to the laboratory, but they're available on a confidential basis, and the only person who can have access to the information is the person who requested it, that is, the individual themselves. Only one of the HIV tests that I was able to find is FDA approved. It's a home health or home access test, and that information goes, directly to the individual under a carefully controlled confidentiality basis. The question comes up whether the representative would advocate for these types of tests. That's not certainly not the case. I wouldn't. I personally will, would only go to a source that I think is demonstrated reliable, realizing there's always room for some errors in any kind of laboratory test, but on a personal basis, I obviously would prefer to have somebody that has a fairly good batting average, and I suppose in relationship to this, on another committee I'm on, somebody I'd have access to test the tort reform, perhaps if the case were necessary for it. The practice, is generally out there, and the procedure is generally out there that the individual has a right, a basic and a fundamental right to the knowledge about their own health. And I think more and more we're seeing that, more and more even the doctors, when you go in, immediately are giving you the test results, to have, and that it's simply the extension or continuation of that particular principle that we're advocating for. We have, on to the other topic, I have absolutely no objection to the amendments and find them to be very appropriate amendments that came forth from the clinical laboratory folks. We think that is something that we should have caught and should have been in the original bill, and apologize to you for even having to have those amendments for you, because they make very good sense to us. And with that, I guess that about covers my points we had, and some of it I apologize is repetition from what you've heard before. And I deeply regret that the Oregon Medical Association did not come to a better position on this. I'd like to have worked out some kind of compromise where we could have been on the same page, but in my opinion, they stayed on the same page they were, and that would have been a waste of would be a waste of your time and my time to have even advanced the bill under those conditions.
Any questions, Representative Mona Sanderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Jensen, just one situation. I agree in probably 95 to 98 to maybe 99% of the cases. Those are the patient's results, and they should have access. But one example was cited to me of a young lady, and I'm not sure if she was a teen or not, but let's say it was a teen, who went to the emergency room for some reason with some symptoms. Well, they ended up doing a pregnancy test, and evidently that was really all she wanted to know was whether she was pregnant or not. And maybe she had done a home pregnancy test. She just wanted to have confirmation. She left and never saw her again. Is that if a physician anyway had been able to at least address a 15-year-old or a 16-year-old, she could have maybe, you know, been, instead of going off and getting an abortion, it could have been talked to a little bit. How would you address that? I mean, I have just reservations about a few situations.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mona Sanderson, could I have a clarification? Did you say she went to an emergency room?
Yes. With other symptoms, but what she really wanted was a pregnancy test or a confirmation of a pregnancy test. And she got it, and she was pregnant, and
whatever.
She was out of there. Yeah, but that was in an ER. Yeah.
Representative Mona Sanderson, Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I don't know whether she had an abortion or whether she didn't have an abortion, whether she used it as leverage with a boyfriend or
right.
Whatever the case may be is difficult to know. But I would think that when the individual went to the emergency room to get a test for whatever the motivation might or might not have been, that there would have been in the emergency room a physician, and I suppose my thought would be that if something like this comes back, the physician ought to have taken the time at that particular point to find out what was going on as far as the young woman was concerned. So I think that I'm not exactly sure. You know, I do appreciate that people may do those sort of things, go someplace else to, you know, to get a test like this. Some of us would probably view this as an abuse of the system as far as emergency rooms are concerned. And on an area that you all are very deeply concerned with here, I think, as far as controlling costs, in this whole area of health care, whether it happens to be folks that are on the Oregon Health Plan or whether it happens to be others. I mean, the idea of trying to not have people go to emergency rooms unless it's a real bona fide emergency, because that's the most expensive medical care that we can get, and it's very difficult for us to continue to pay for that.
Well, I guess, follow up, I guess the only point was that if a person then could just get their results from a lab, at least an emergency room, there would have been something, but all they would be getting their results from a lab without any counseling.
The,
that's my concern.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, the lab... the lab that referring to home health testing that referring to here that and this happens to be only on an HIV they do all sorts of other things but those labs do provide a, if you wish, warning label, and when they call back, when people call back to them and get their results, they are counseled that either this is a result that needs to be verified or checked in another way, or this is a result that needs to, you need to seek other medical attention on, or a suggestion that it's imperative that you consult your, family physician or primary care doctors, the case may be. I think the same thing is true of other labs. Radiology lab clinic in my hometown routinely sends out the mammogram results immediately to the people who have taken the mammogram. I think we're all aware that a negative on a mammogram test is very stressful. It's calculated to be very stressful as far as people getting those. And the diagnostic lab, does have a statement that goes out with the results that, this is a first finding. You need to do further testing. You need to consult with your primary care physician. Sort of thing goes with it. And I don't have any problem with, I think that's appropriate and the sort of information that should be given. And anyone who is smart enough or careful enough, maybe is a better word, to want to have access to their records is going to be careful enough to read the, all of the material, I think, that goes with it.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I couldn't agree more fully with Representative Jensen that patients' records are theirs, that they are the doctor's records, but the information should be accessible to the patient at all times. But I do have a major concern that that could be a surprise factor for some folks that it would not be healthy for. On a routine blood test to show up something that could be a real backsided surprise for a patient that they didn't suspect coming, and that the counsel of a physician who knows their whole health is wise, which is the present system. Had you considered at all having a selection where the patient could say, I want those results direct to me, or I will accept them going to the doctor first?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, please understand that my bill does not bar the doctor from getting them immediately. The doctor will get, as they do now, the test results as soon as the lab has finished them and sent them in the same manner that they're sending them at the present time.
They're going in two directions, one to the patient, one to the doctor at the same time?
Yes, but the only time they go to the patient is on the patient's request. That's what the bill is asking for. Some
didn't see that.
Some are doing it without the patient asking for it. I mean, some places are doing it without the patient asking for it. But the bill is only addressing at the patient's request. And it is certainly and adamantly feel that the doctor has to have this information and has to have it immediately.
Okay.
Type of thing. It would be a gross abuse of the system for doctors to not have immediate access to this.
Okay.
Any other questions? Do you have anything to add, Tim?
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, again, Tim Martinez. I share the representative's regret that we couldn't come to an agreeable compromise on this issue. But again, the OMA does feel very strongly that there are examples of tests that ought to be talked about. The other representative and the OMA agree, whether it's 90, 95%, 98%, we don't have a problem with that. It's those rare cases that we would be precluded from doing any other way than the way this bill is set up. So if the patient said, I want it, and I, you know, don't necessarily want to come in and talk about it, we would have no options just without the dash threes. So we would encourage your support.
Okay, committee, I would like to move some version of this bill today. We have the dash two amendments that everybody's agreed on and the dash threes that everybody hasn't agreed on. So it's the pleasure of the committee.
Chair.
Representative Westland.
I move the dash two amendments into House Bill 2631.
Representative Westland moves the dash two amendment into House Bill 2631. Any discussion?
Yes. What does it actually do? I just want to make sure I understand. How does that change the bill, again, Sandy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, the dash two amendment on line 10 of the bill changes the or to an and. So at that point, it's the patient and the physician, dentist, their agents.
Okay.
And it adds in section two, beginning on line 14, with the amendment, it reads, the amendments to ORS 438-430 by Section 1 of this Act, 2003 Act, apply to the reporting of a result of any test, examination, or analysis of a specimen submitted for diagnosis, prevention, or treatment of any disease or impairment of, or the assessment of the health of human beings. And that new language is the exact same language that they use in the federal definition of specimen. So that was brought forward as clarification by the Clinical Laboratory Association.
Gotcha.
Okay. Any other questions on the dash two amendments? Are there any objection to the dash two amendments? Seeing none, the dash two amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mona Sanderson.
I'd like to see if the dash threes would pass this committee, so I move that we adopt the dash three amendment.
Representative Mona Sanderson moves the dash three amendment to House Bill 2631. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I just have concerns about pregnancy tests, about HIV, AIDS, and sexually transmitted diseases. Those are the only things that I'm most concerned about, having worked with that personally.
Mr. Chair, may I?
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The sponsor of the bill would entertain on the Senate side a provision that at the time of the prescribing, okay, of the order for the tests, that the physician have a right to explain to the patient that this is a sensitive test, and I do not want you to have immediate access until we've had a chance to talk about it. I would be willing to entertain trying on the Senate side to work with the OMA to try to get such an amendment so that the doctor would know up front that the individual is looking for or will be asking for this information, and they will have an opportunity to address the issue at the time of prescribing of the tests.
Representative Dalto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for the indulgence. Representative Jensen, would you entertain perhaps an exclusion for the concerns that Representative Mona Sanderson brought up for a few narrow tests?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dalto, no, I'd argue against the bill on the floor.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would walk on hot coals for Representative Jensen.
But I share some of Representative Anderson's and Representative Monis Anderson's concerns. I can imagine, I thought what Representative Monis Anderson was going to talk about was somebody going in for a test for pregnancy and finding out that maybe she had HIV/AIDS and had no idea. And that's what I think what Representative Anderson was saying, that something could come out of the blue that you had no idea. And the kinds of tests that you're referring to that one can get over the Internet, you know that you're finding out if you have that. But what I'm concerned about is somebody who had no idea that they might have something that's life-threatening and would get something in the mail that go on for pregnancy tests but found out that they had HIV/AIDS and find out...
Mr. Chair, may I please? What kind of a physician is going to prescribe a test of this type that doesn't talk to the patient about it prior to the time they prescribe the test? I'm sorry.
Okay, I would not walk on hot coals for Representative Jensen.
Rose petals, Mr. Chair?
You know, that just sounds too darn painful. But I would go to battle with him and have gone to battle with him. And I want to honor his concern here. And the chair would prefer to not adopt the dash threes and allow further discussions to go on the Senate side. So this is a genuine concern from somebody I consider to be a very close friend, and that would be my preference. I, as reluctant as I am to send unfinished products through, I think there's still more room to maneuver here, but we're running out of time. So
I still have to vote no, even though I have the highest regard for the representative.
Mr. Chair, the representative appreciates the kind words. The representative, however, asked the committee to vote for good public policy.
Well, anyway.
I just want to say, I hate the guy, but I'm going to vote.
You haven't had the privilege of sitting on his committee, as I have for two sessions now. Do we have a dash three amendment on the table? Is there any further discussion on the dash three? Seeing none, I think we better have a roll call on this one.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Barker?
No.
This is the dash three.
Dash three.
No.
Representative
Monis Anderson?
Yes.
Representative
Tomei?
No.
Representative Westman?
Nope. Chair, please. No. The dash three amendment by House Bill 2631, having not received the constitutional majority, has failed. We're left with the bill as amended with the dash twos.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2631 is amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Westland moves House Bill 2631 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Galton.
Aye.
Representative Monis
Anderson.
No.
Representative
Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Westland. Aye. Aye. House Bill 2631, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Jensen will carry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and we will close the work session on House Bill 2631 and open a work session on House Bill 3508. Sandy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3508 is, we heard the bill on Monday the 7th. This is the bill that deals with the education, regulating of qualifications, training, education, and supervision of persons who operate x-ray machines within a dentist's office. Currently is housed in the Oregon, the Office of Public Health, Department of Human Services oversees the program. It is being transferred or being requested to go back to the Oregon Board of Dentistry. We have no amendments at this time on the bill.
Any discussion?
How did
Representative Monis Anderson?
Thank you. Regarding DHS, they were in opposition, correct? And there were no amendments made. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, that's all I need to know.
Representative Anderson, do you have a?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. While I fully support the registration of dental X-ray machines within dental offices by the Oregon Health Department, I really think that the convenience for the dental assistants by taking that out of the health department and giving it back to the Board of Dental Examiners is an area of great convenience. The dental assistants have their own testing. Dental Assisting National Board, which qualifies them to take and provide adequate X-ray with safety, with training in radiology, as well as in taking the actual little films. So I think there's plenty of safeguards to the public. It makes it much more easy for the dental assistant out in the rural areas of our state to be governed over by the Board of Dental Examiners than I think by the dental by the health department. And I would encourage your vote to make this change.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Mona Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My only concern with this is what other boards or professions are going to want to take away their oversight from DHS? And I know this is really very different, but like the restaurants saying, they really wanted to oversee their restaurant inspections because they can do that. I personally feel it's nice to have another entity doing the oversight when it comes to public safety, and that is my concern. The board of dentistry, I'm sure, is very honorable, but I would prefer to see this stay with DHS. Thank you.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, Representative Dalto.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3508 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Dalto moves House Bill 3508 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Barker.
Aye.
Representative Dalto.
Aye.
Representative Monis Anderson.
No.
Representative May.
Aye.
Representative Weston.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 3508, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. Representative Anderson will carry.
Sure.
We'll close the work session on House Bill 3508 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2963. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, 2963 is creating a task force on homeless and runaway youth for the purposes of assessing the current status of the homeless and runaway youth in Oregon and making any recommendations to improve the statewide system of care for the homeless and the runaway youth and their families. It has a sunset date of January 2, 2006, as well as an emergency clause.
Okay. If we can add another chair, I'll call up Ramona Foley, Donna Middleton, Galen and Jane. Let's just have everybody up here together and do some sort of bonding thing. It's Friday, for God's sake.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Please, however you want to proceed.
Want to start? Dealing or?
Yes. I guess by consensus it's me. Good morning, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Jean Lassiter, and I am a member of the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. And I have given you some information. What you have in front of you, or will soon have, is a summary of issues surrounding homeless and runaway youth, both nationally and locally, from the state to the local tri-county areas, and a review of what a typical homeless and runaway youth shelter program offers to these young people, as well as a survey that was conducted, an informal survey that was conducted across the state, and you have the organizations that provided information for that survey. I also have a summary statement regarding issues surrounding the care and advocacy for homeless and runaway youth, and a letter with recommendations from the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. So that's enough reading material for a while. I'd like to start and finish quickly, so we won't be here too long, but I have some summary information about this population, and probably I'm preaching to the choir, but I think it's important to know that extreme family conflict, physical, emotional, and sexual abuse and neglect are reported as chief causal factors for running away. The Oregon Alliance of Children's Programs report that almost 75% of the youth in its shelter facilities have been victims of abuse or neglect. In a shelter survey conducted in 1997, 21 counties representing 53% of the state's youth population estimated that 893 youth were placed in detention due to lack of shelter resources. Results from a survey of homeless juveniles in detention in Yamhill County showed that most of them were homeless because they could not get along with parents, siblings, and others in the house. Most indicated that drug and alcohol counseling would help them, as would programs to help them get back in school. Most had been homeless several times before taking the survey, and the vast majority said they would have stayed in a shelter or safe home had it been available to them. I think that part of this discussion, I think that there's a vast amount of knowledge about this population, and I think that this is an issue that has beleaguered us from many standpoints over the years. And in giving you information about runaway and homeless youth programs, there are six programs that are federally supported in the state of Oregon. And those programs serve as centers and service points for at-risk youth, including runaway and homeless youth. We serve thousands of children every year in these programs. And the target population of the runaway and homeless youth programs is a group of children and their families, and I do want to emphasize children. These are children. These are 12, 13, 14, 15-year-old children who are outside of their homes, who have run away because they don't know what else to do. So they come to our shelters in the thousands across the state. We provide counseling, respite care, resource and referral, advocacy, and I think that what's really critical to this discussion is that the problems are getting worse. The children are getting younger. The issues that we're seeing in our runaway and homeless shelters are getting more and more extreme. There's a prevalence of self-injurious behavior in children that are getting younger and younger. There is an increasing apathy, if you will, on the part of parents. And apathy is a term that I use to refer to an inability, a lack of skills, a lack of initiative, a lack of resources to respond to the issues that their children are facing, and that sometimes those parents are toxic. So I really think that you know, my point in really being here in support of what was presented as a bill, I guess, without knowing the protocol, House Bill 2963, and now is a recommendation for a task force. What I want to say is that the Oregon Runaway and Homeless Youth Coalition has been working for several years to find a place in this state where service for these young people is coordinated and advocated for across systems. And our recommendations on behalf of these children are that we integrate services and leverage federal and private funding in caring for runaway and homeless teens. Those six runaway and homeless programs provide millions of dollars in federal resources to provide care and integrated services for these young people. We look at this as a system issue. This is a system issue. This is going to really take all of us. We're all up here. We've been asked to bond, and we've bonded on a number of occasions, and all for the good of children. So I think that we're all, at least on my part, I think that there's a good understanding about caring for these kids. I would like to see us have culturally and gender appropriate access and services, and I think that if the recommendation is to be that this task force be convened, that the Runaway and Homeless Youth Coalition is happy to take that lead, and we just want to find a solution, and we want, really speaking from my heart, for all children in the state to be cared for. And at this point in time, and for several years past, these particular children, between 15 and 20,000 of them, have been lost in the shadows and fallen through cracks. And I think that I'd like to join the discussion with my colleagues and my community members to see that resolved.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Let's hold questions until the panel has spoken, all of them. So who would like to be next?
You want me to go next? Madam Could Chair, you? Galen Phipps with the Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition. The intent of House Bill 2963, as stated earlier, is to create a homeless and runaway youth task force. The purpose of the task force is to begin a statewide coordinated conversation about this population and make recommendations regarding state policy and an appropriate surface of care for these young people. The Oregon Homeless and Runaway Youth Coalition and the Oregon Commission on Children and Families Positive Youth Development Demonstration Project that Donna Middleton will talk about in a few minutes has been working on this issue for some time, and we've really been unable to expand the conversation statewide. Gene Lassiter spoke about the issues that this bill is describing, and it is our wish that we minimize the fiscal impact of this bill, and as a result, the coalition agrees to convene and staff this task force. And that we want to enforce that that the CHS Child Welfare and the Oregon Commission on Children and Families is a vital part of this task force, and to enter into this the statewide conversation. I have also had indications from legislators and certainly other interested parties that are willing and able to attend and participate in this task force. One of the things that I am hoping is that we really need the endorsement of the task force from this committee. And as a result, I'd like to recommend that the House Human Services Committee order us back in the interim in September of 2004 to give our findings and recommendations to the committee, that then we can give our results back to you and then move forward on further strategies. Thank you.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Donna Middleton. I'm the director of the State Commission on Children and Families. As Galen mentioned, we have been a participant for a number of years around positive youth development. I have handed out to our positive youth development one-pager with policy recommendations. As you will notice, the number one policy recommendation is the issue of runaway and homeless youth. We will, regardless of legislation, continue to partner with a statewide effort to look at this population. We intend to do that and have always intended to do that, and we'll be fully participating in this process. I also would like to add to this is that one of the things that I am most concerned about this population is the prevention of this population. One of the things we always do is we work on, you know, instead of working on the cause, we work on the outcome. In other words, what happens when young people are early on parented well and supported well. Then we have a runaway and homeless population, and I always worry that if you build it, they will come. And it's true. We also need to deal with why children are leaving their homes. And so my recommendation, if we're going to do a task force, would be to look very holistically at this population, not just at what the needs of the current population are, but holistically, because quite frankly, we don't do a very good job in the state of looking at the causes. We do a lot at the crisis. And so we would fully participate, but I really want to have us look at the whole situation rather than an individual population as it currently exists. So that would be.
Good morning, Ramona.
Chair Cruz and members of the committee, my name is Ramona Foley, and I'm an assistant director with the Department of Human Services. We also support the concept of having a task force to look at this particular issue. But I would also point out, I came to Oregon 3.5 years ago, and when I arrived, one of the first things I was told is that we have a huge problem with homeless and runaway youth. And in looking at the Annie E. Casey Kids Count data, one of the things I saw was that Oregon is distinguished for having one of the highest populations of youth between the ages of 16 and 19 who are neither in school nor in jobs. And that immediately gives you a clue that maybe something is not going in the right direction in terms of the youth that we need to be serving in our state. Because Oregon has this disproportionate population compared to other states, I also looked to see if it was simply a phenomena of Portland or if this is a problem statewide. As it turns out, it is a problem statewide. 3 years ago, Klamath County had as many as 400 youth who were considered homeless and living on the streets. So the big question for us in participating in this task force is also to ask why. What is it that is unique about Oregon? What is it that's attracting kids to Oregon? Are these kids coming all from Oregon, or do they come from other states? Why is it that we've ended up with this problem? And we own some of this at the Department of Human Services. There was a myth for many years that we didn't serve teenagers. And it was not only a myth. When I looked at the caseloads 3.5 years ago, sure enough, there was a significant drop in children in our caseloads after about the age of 12 and 14. And that tells us that we have to do a better job of children who are in the caseloads who are known to the Department of Human Services. How can we better serve those kids so that they are not part of this population of homeless and runaway youth? We've done a couple of things in the department. We've done a new child protection assessment, which will now help our workers assess risk and safety to teenagers and not just children under 12 years of age. We've also trained around the issue of serving teenagers in the department in caseloads. We have a statutory advisory subcommittee on serving teens, and we have an agency-wide committee in the department around teens known across all of our programs in the Department of Human Services. So we would be very excited about serving on this committee and with the also the charge from you all to look at the issue of parental responsibility. I think we have to address parental responsibility, and by statute we address that when children are known to the child welfare system. It's also in statute for children not known, but I'm not sure that that's really clearly articulated. Earlier, Jean mentioned the whole philosophy around how we go about serving the homeless and runaway youth, and at the same time, we tend to not pay as much attention, I'm afraid, to the parents. And we need to have the parents engaged in that conversation. So for us, we, as I said, we are interested in participating. We want to participate, but also would see this as looking not just as the problem. And I know Jean and Galen do an excellent job of serving these children after they need the shelter service, but also for you all to really ask us to come back and say, what do we know about what's contributing to the problem? And I would suggest that on our task force, we might want to add a parent. We have a teen and we have a runaway shelter representative, but a parent and perhaps someone from the court system, because the courts also have oftentimes have knowledge of these cases. So thank you very much.
Questions? I'm going to take a little different approach with this. We've had history over the last couple of sessions of creating lots and lots of task forces that are kind of outside regular interim legislative work, to the point in some cases where we've actually impacted the ability of the interim committees to be able to afford to do their business. So what my intention is, assuming at some point in time we do actually get to an interim, that really wasn't funny, was it? is to try to make more things the business of the interim committees. And as I read this bill, and I'm supportive of this study, and as I read this bill, it clearly is asking everybody to volunteer their time to be part of this, and I have no problem with that. So what I would like to do as the chair of this committee is direct you folks, and I think Ramona had a valid point that we may need to include more folks than what's here, and whoever you think is appropriate to convene. And what we will do is have a report from this work group, and we'll call it task force, call it a work group, at every meeting of the interim committee. Hopefully through that process, not only can we educate, because the interim committee will be joint, and so we can not only educate both House and Senate members on this issue, but I think through that process we would be in a better position if we're going to have a legislative package to kind of form that. So fully supportive, and I'm giving you a directive, and so this is from the chair of the committee, and I think that carries weight. So and a commitment to you from me that it will be part of the agenda and business of the Interim Human Services Committee.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2963. Thank you all for coming. I really appreciate this.
No work session.
No, we don't. No, these are just public hearings only, but we gave them the directions, so I think.
Oh, so we don't need a work session?
No, I just did it.
Okay.
We don't need the bill.
Okay, good.
I mean, I'm
just
going
to do it.
Great.
It's a different way of doing business.
Yeah. So. Good to meet you.
Okay. Let's see. I think I'm going to go a little bit out of order here. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3394 because Representative Bates is here and Representative Backlund is here. And no, we'll let them, no staff measure summary here. I think these two gentlemen can elocute very well, so.
Mr. Chair, thank
you. Big word, wasn't
it? Yeah, that's okay. I won't ask you to spell it.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you for moving us out the schedule. We've got a lot of people here to testify today, and I do appreciate your cooperation. For the record, Alan Bates from Ashland, state representative. I'm going to talk you through a bill which, unfortunately, you have in front of you without the final amendments. Those won't be out until Monday or Tuesday. But the information we'll give you will be substantiated by those amendments when you see them. This idea really originated for me 4 or 5 years ago when I was still chief of medicine at Rogue Valley Community Hospital and Province Hospital. Now, those institutions I saw our trauma system slowly and steadily degrading. We were dropping from what's called a level 2 to a level 3 trauma center. We were losing our time as far as how fast we could see patients in the trauma system. And we were running into problems of the breadth of what we could do. We were shipping more and more patients all the time. As that system degraded, we began looking at how other states were managing to maintain their system and found out that Washington State was doing a reasonably good job of maintaining their system. They had enough money in the system to hire physicians as far as orthopedists, trauma surgeons, anesthesiologists, and maintain their trauma center infrastructure statewide, including their ambulance services and air services, something we were having a difficult time with. After a great deal of effort, we found out how Washington State had done it, and they'd done it in a very slick way, in a way we want to try to imitate here in this state. There are basically four pairs of trauma systems. You got Medicaid, you got Medicare, you got your commercial insurance, and you got your automobile insurance, your PIP. Medicaid pays about half the actual cost of what you're doing in the trauma system. Medicare probably pays 90%. Commercial is close to full. And your PIP, for the part it covers, which is limited, does pay full also, leaving some huge holes in that. What Washington State did was pass a law that they had a transfer tax on every car when it got sold for $10. $6 went into the trauma system and $4 stayed with the dealer. The tricky part about it was they took that $6 and put it only into the Medicaid part of the trauma system. And the key here is you get a 60-40 match from the federal government when you do that. So their $6 more than doubled itself by putting it through that system. And that's what we want to do in this state. We want to put $10 million into the system annually and get $25 million out of it for the system to stabilize the system by making that Medicaid match, one we're failing to do now. Unfortunately, in this state, we're blocked from using a transfer tax on automobiles or a surtax on insurance premiums for automobiles because by constitutional law, that all has to go into maintaining the roads. We've looked at that carefully. We couldn't get there. The next best nexus for this was 911. Now, you're going to hear today, I'm sure, that this is a bad thing for 911. You're also going to hear it's a good thing for 911. That 911 fund does not completely cover the county's cost of their call centers. Never was intended to, and it doesn't. But what you want to have happen when you call 911 is you want somebody at the other end's going to take care of you. You want that poison control center there. You want to have a trauma system that works there, and we are losing those in this state. So it's nice to have a call system that gets your phone number through, but it doesn't mean much if nothing happens at the other end. The ambulance doesn't pick you up. Nobody comes to your place. You don't get taken care of when you go to the hospital. You should also know that in California, an initiative is being formed right now to try to put 911 money on the ballot for 75 cents per line to fund emergency rooms and trauma systems. So this is not an absolutely new idea. This bill is designed to stabilize a system in the state that is actually in jeopardy, which most people don't realize. You're going to hear more testimony about this. I believe people have already died in the state because our system doesn't work as well as it used to. This thing came out of the Vietnam experience, the golden first hour of taking care of patients who had been traumatized. You lose that hour, you lose the breadth of your system to take care of this, and people die, and I believe you'll hear some testimony today indicating that's already happening. We need to save the system. We need to reconstruct it. That's what this bill does. I know there's controversy about the funding source, but nobody's arguing about the rest of it. I'm asking you to look at the nexus between 911, the need for the system, and realize we have to go in this direction. That's the end of my testimony. I'll turn it over to Representative Backlund.
Thank you very much, Representative Bates. Good morning. Good morning, Vice Chair and members of the committee. I am Representative Vic Backlund from House District 25. And I'm here for a couple of reasons, actually. One is I was kind of brought into the trauma system kind of at the edge of it when I was the legislative reference point, I guess, for the task force on the Oregon brain injury effort. And in the course of that work, in the interim, we developed a bill. And out of that, Representative Bates saw that we were working in that direction, and we kind of collaborated since, feeling that we need kind of an omnibus approach to trauma, to dealing with trauma. And so this bill does that, and I think it does it very, very well. It involves all kinds of services in the area and the field of trauma care. The 911 fees that Representative Bates referred to involves a 25-cent additional charge to the current 75 cents. But look what it funds. The trauma care system is funded here, and this includes physician, hospital, ambulance and airlift charges. It provides funding for pediatric trauma care and the Emergency Medical Services for Children program. We're talking truly an omnibus approach here. A portion of the 25 cents goes to poison control, and poison control truly is trauma, in case anyone would wonder why that has been included. And also drug information program is included in the poison control. And then a portion, a small portion, is dedicated to the Brain Injury Commission, the work that that I did in the interim. I think when you look at the whole picture, we have a very good bill, we have a very good concept, and we would certainly urge you to support it.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I might also add that the PIP increase, which the insurers have agreed to, is the first increase since the 1970s, and we appreciate them stepping up and making that minimum of $10,000, moving it to $15,000. It will bring in some extra money to the system, not a huge amount, but some extra money to the system, which we appreciate them stepping up and doing.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Representative Monasanto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Voters, telephone, those who have telephones are going to say, well, this is a tax increase. We're now raising our telephone bills to pay for medical care. And I'm not sure, when I take a look at my phone bill, how happy people are going to be about this. Because what, over the last 10 or 15 years, our telephone bills have just skyrocketed. And I don't know why, not due to medical care. So how, I love the idea of getting more money for trauma care, for poison control, for brain injury, but is this the right way to do it? And I think you've tried to address it, but I'm just looking at it from a person who pays a telephone bill. Here's just another increase, and instead of getting taxes for it, or this is another way of doing it. Do you, any other? I know you've made some good arguments.
Okay. Madam Chair, Representative Mons Anderson, I actually thought about that myself, too, and I asked the CEO of my hospital locally about what was going on in California, this very issue. And they actually polled it very carefully, and I'll try to get those polls for you. The public was strongly in favor in that state, apparently, from what he's told me, that they thought this was an appropriate way to raise money for your emergency room and for your trauma care. Now, I haven't got that exact poll, but I'll try to find it for you. And I think most people feel that when they see that 911 fee down there, they're kind of assuming, and I've had people tell me this, that that's covering the trauma system. When I call up, somebody's there, the trauma center's there, I talk to somebody on the phone, and they move us on through. I think what most people don't know, and I would give this to the opposition, so to speak, is that 911 money we collect is not adequate for the call centers, even as it is. And we're not asking and taking anything from them. That first 75 cents would still go to them. But it's not adequate for the cost of those call centers. You might make your call centers a little more efficient, but even if you did, you're not going to have enough to cover the whole call center anyway. People have accepted 911 fee, I believe, because they think it relates to what happens in an emergency. And I would go back to my original statement. The 911 money, if you have nobody on the end of the phone taking care of you, is pretty meaningless. And we will try to get the information from California for you.
And did you say, Paula, it was 25 cents per month per...
Per phone.
Per phone.
It's 75...
Per home or per household? We have a lot
per
of...
Per phone. Per phone. It's 75 cents per phone per month right now. This would raise it to a dollar.
So something like the state, which has hundreds of phones, it will increase it dramatically.
It's a very small amount of money, 75 cents to a dollar. Well, it's a significant increase from 75 cents to a dollar. It's overall a small amount of money spread across the entire state. We're talking $10 million, which will be leveraged into $25 million by using the Medicaid program. It's a huge leveraging of money.
Madam Chair, and Representative Monis Anderson, I kind of looked at the issue this way. And by the way, your question is obviously a very, very important one and a very good one in this current climate. But I guess I weigh, if we could use the word evils, the evil of a fee increase when compared to the benefits that the trauma system would bring us, when you compare it that way, I think the fee increase is well worth it. I think the benefits well justify the fee increase.
And to speak to a broader aspect of this, in our present financial crisis of the state, I think we're going to see a lot more bills like this. It's the only way to get us in a position where we don't lose critical services in this state, not only the trauma system, but others. So while you might have some difficulty with this, and I understand that, I think it's a tight nexus. It's one people expect, and I think it's a reasonable and frankly, the only area we can go to move the trauma system forward and maintain it.
Thank you.
Representative Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Bates, you mentioned the PIP insurance, too. Are we going to hear more on that? Or
We've tried to get – we have a very short time here, but we will try to get more information for you on that. PIP moving from 10 to 15,000 minimum does bring some more money in the system. We've tried to calculate how much that was. Most of your trauma goes well past $15,000. If you have a major trauma case, it's $50,000 or more very quickly. But there's very few of those cases, thank goodness. And so the extra $5,000 that would be fed into the system from those few cases is helpful, and we appreciate that.
So that's just an add-on.
But you need to know that first $10,000, for the most part, 90% of it is used and spent on chiropractors and physical therapists for what I consider fender benders, whiplashes and things that are important to people, but they're not life-threatening. So most of that money never gets into the trauma system. This extra $5,000 is dedicated only to trauma. It won't go anywhere else. And so we won't lose that money into the system.
Thank you.
Thank you. I have a question. So our cell phones also, would they be having the same tax expense?
Madam Chair, absolutely. They already have.
Okay.
They're there now.
Good. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Could we call up Dr. William Long and Marianne Wish?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dr. Excuse me.
Thanks.
William Long. Trauma Medical Director at Emanuel Hospital in Portland. I'm also the chairman of the State Trauma Advisory Board and chairman of the Oregon Chapter of American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma. And so I have a good understanding of what's going on with the trauma system since I've been here since 1983 trying to put this system together or help put it together. Let me just review a little bit about the system. From the time of injury, the critically injured patient is in danger of dying from a brain injury, lack of oxygen, bleeding from external or internal wounds. It is a race against time to get the patient from the scene of an accident to a hospital that can take care of the patient's injuries quickly and correctly. The 911 system was created to facilitate the public alerting the police, fire, and ambulance that an accident had occurred and to help initiate a rapid response from these agencies. Police, fire, and ambulance personnel have been trained to reduce the pre-hospital time as much as possible, get the patient bleeding to death to the operating room where the bleeding could be controlled. Medically configured helicopters in several areas of the state provide services to help reduce the time to travel the vast distances between the accident scene and trauma hospital. And this is especially important in rural Oregon. For the patient to arrive at a hospital and to go quickly to the operating room requires an extraordinary coordination between pre-hospital care providers, emergency physicians and nurses, and anesthesia and surgical specialists and operating room nurses. Surgical specialists have to be committed to a call schedule and a response within minutes of a stat request for their services. They have to work as a team because many of these patients have multiple injuries and need coordinated care and surgeries. The Oregon trauma system has been working. There has been a decline in the death rates for motor vehicle accidents, victims of violence, and motorcyclists. National regional experts in trauma on behalf of the Oregon Health Division have come to this state and reviewed the medical records of participating trauma centers and inspected patient care areas and affirmed that high-quality trauma care is being provided. However, there are problems or clouds on the horizon. The declining reimbursement rate for surgery, the increasing numbers of emergency and trauma patients without insurance, the rising malpractice premiums are causing many surgeons to stop taking trauma call completely or to limit their practice to non-emergencies only. This jeopardizes the integrity and the intent of the Oregon trauma system. This also increases the cost of emergency and trauma health care because patients and their families will have to travel further to get their emergency care. Let's get specific. There are, or were, five neurosurgeons in Medford area who shared emergency and trauma call. One group of three neurosurgeons have decided for cost and inconvenience of the ED call to move to Ashland to avoid these problems. This places the trauma call burden on the remaining two neurosurgeons, an impossible burden for the community to expect of these two surgeons. The Medford community will most likely be transferring patients with severe brain injuries to Eugene or Portland. However, in Eugene, the neurosurgeons decided 1 year ago to consolidate their brain trauma to one hospital, Sacred Heart, to offer better patient care for that community. Then the malpractice premium increases came. The cost of doing traumatic brain injuries alone rose $30,000 per neurosurgeon. There's not enough volume of traumatic brain injuries to offset that cost increase. If the Eugene neurosurgeons choose to transfer all brain injuries needing surgery, emergency surgery to Corvallis, Salem, or Portland, there will be a morbidity and a mortality associated with the transfers, and there will be an extra cost incurred by the community and the patients for those transfers. This situation, just in this one specialty, undermines the very intent and design for the Oregon trauma system. There is no emergency malpractice risk for surgeons who limit their practice to non-emergencies and are not available for emergency patients needing their skills. There is no default on the physician's medical licensure because the physician does not take emergency call for the hospital. Hospitals, however, are on the hook as acute care hospitals because they must provide services commensurate with the community. Hospital administrators have tried to hire surge specialists to cover the emergency department, but there is an insufficient volume of emergency insured patients to support the cost of hiring specialists, insufficient number to guarantee the call schedule 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. There must be a way to provide incentives for surgical specialists in the community to stay in the community, to add partners to replace retiring surgeons as they get older, and to be compensated fairly for providing timely emergency trauma care for the community. It is ironic that Oregon was the first Western state to create a statewide trauma system. We were the first to recognize the value of Level 3 and Level 4 trauma centers for rural areas and their roles in helping the critically ill and injured to move expeditiously to a higher level of care. moving a critically injured patient from the beach community, for example, to the Eugene or Portland to get sophisticated and timely care requires tremendous communication, coordination, and commitment of many agencies and hospitals and physicians. Somehow, the compensation of the hospital's physicians and surgeons requiring the immediate and long-term, providing the immediate and long-term care for these patients has been forgotten. I think if the Oregon legislature wants this level of trauma care to continue, then something must be done to correct this problem. Adjusting the PIP and adding the charge to the 911 system are appropriate measures to fund the care that is being provided and to help retain the services of the trauma providers in each community without having to dislocate the families and the patients unnecessarily. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Doctor.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I apologize. I'm a little groggy this morning. I'll do my best. My name is Mary Ann Seth Wish. I live at 1537 Southeast 72nd Avenue in Portland. I am here today to speak for House Bill 3394. The tragic accident of our granddaughter's death showed us that Oregon's trauma system should be better. March 25, 2001 was the usual Sunday morning. My husband and I went to church and did some errands. When we got home about 1:45, we listened to the one answering machine message. Our daughter, Lisa, was calling. Her message was, as always, very concise. Mom and Dad, Jean's been in a terrible accident at the beach. Go to Emmanuel Hospital now. Oh, no. Our beautiful 13-year-old tap dancer, our artist, pianist, honor student, no. Jean, her sister Helen, and their parents were at the coast for an Anderson family reunion, along with her paternal grandparents and three uncles and their families. Jean was rolled over by a several thousand pound, 25-foot long log while surfing with her father and two uncles at Short Sands Beach in Oswald West State Park. Her accident occurred approximately 11:15. Within a minute or two, she was pulled from beneath the log and given mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. She regained consciousness. She knew who she was and where she was and what had happened to her. She talked with her uncles and father. She said that it hurt to breathe. In the meantime, a witness at the beach, using his cell phone, called 911. Even though the connection was poor, Tillamook 911 quickly dispatched an ambulance from Manzanita and two fire trucks from Nehalem. At 11:27, the ambulance arrived at the parking lot. Shortly thereafter, the EMT paramedic announced a trauma system entry and requested a Coast Guard rescue helicopter. He did not request an air ambulance. Jean was transferred from the surfboard to a Stoke stretcher and moved to another spot on the beach at 11:55, after which they waited and waited. The Coast Guard helicopter arrived at 12:20. A half hour later, as Jean was winched into the hovering helicopter, her last words to her father were, "Daddy, I can't breathe. I think I'm going to die." The helicopter arrived at Emmanuel Hospital at 13:50, two hours and 35 minutes after the accident. I was with her in the OR when she was pronounced dead at 15:31. The EMS system failed our granddaughter. There was no golden hour for Jean. Jean became another statistic in unintentional injury deaths in Oregon. The comparative statistics from 1999 show Oregon as worse than California, worse than Washington, and worse than the national average. And you have this attachment. I believe passage of House Bill 3394 could lower Oregon's trauma death rate. Improved training, including the importance of quickly moving victims from the scene, as well as new protocols concerning launch and use of air ambulances, could make a big difference. Regulations establishing minimum standards based on those used in California for integrating EMS aircraft and personnel into the existing system are needed. a patient advocate should be a member of both the State Trauma Advisory Board and the State Emergency Medical Services Committee. Neither of these two legislative changes have any budgetary impact. I miss my granddaughter. I ache for her parents. As the maternal grandmother, I can't give a kiss and a Band-Aid and make it better for either Lisa or Jean. But I would like to know that Jean's death has helped bring about a better trauma system for others. I strongly support House Bill 3394, and I'm glad it includes an increase in the PIP minimums as well as an increase in 911 fees. Passage of House Bill 3394 will raise the probability of better trauma care. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
I'd just like to say, Doctor, I've been in your emergency room in the trauma center there many, many times, and just seen the miracles that your people have performed up there. Just, I want to compliment you on that operation. And as a little aside, in 1980, after St. Helens blew, and President Carter was in town, and he was staying in a hotel closer to another trauma center, and the Secret Service said, "How do we get from here to Emmanuel?" And so that, I think, speaks quite highly of your operations. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for sharing your story with us. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you.
Can we bring up Dick Wilt and Sean Baird, please?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dick Wilt. My wife and I own West Ambulance in Roseburg, Oregon. I'm here to talk to you about House Bill 3394, and I'm in support of it. We see firsthand the trauma victims that are out there. And I think as you drive up and down the I-5 corridor south of Eugene now, you realize that the traffic has greatly increased on Interstate 5 over the past few years, which only means that there's more opportunities for more car crashes and more trauma out there. We wanted to talk about our concern about the reduction in services in the trauma centers and the trauma system of Oregon. I think the trauma system works well when there's fast, efficient, high-quality care given to victims of trauma. Unfortunately, this is in jeopardy because of reduced staffing levels that we have to do on ambulances because of a lower funding of various other agencies. House Bill 3394 would provide some necessary relief to assist in better staffing of our vehicles to maintain the trauma system overall that we have. There may be a misconception out there that ambulances, because they're first on the scene to care for a trauma patient, are also the first to be paid for that care. That's untrue. And one reason it's untrue is we do not gain insurance information at the time we take care of the patient. We get there, we pick up the patient, care for them, and take them to the trauma system, the trauma hospital. And it's often days after that before we get billing information from the hospital about this patient. We do not know whether they're Medicare patients, whether they're healthcare patients, Oregon healthcare patients, or they have private insurance. Of course, that doesn't matter to us. We just know somebody needs help and we go there. 3394 will help address this, and while it won't be the correction of all of our financial woes, it will certainly be an assistance to us. Because we live in rural Oregon, we're also concerned about the trauma care in rural Oregon. Mercy Medical Center is our hospital down there, and there's definitely been talk about should they reduce their trauma services because of the expense. We're by ambulance an hour away from Eugene, which is the next highest level trauma care. And we have to part of our responsibility is to, by ambulance, take people from Mercy Medical Center to a Eugene hospital for a higher level of care. We see a greater number of those transfers coming up, and it's of concern because of the golden hour. It's of concern as citizens of Roseburg what's happening to our system. And so we're asking for your help and support of 3394 and help move along and better help us provide trauma care to people who need it.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Sean Baird. I'm a paramedic. I am an owner of an ambulance service in Woodburn and currently the president of the State Ambulance Association. As a paramedic responding to calls in my area, just 2 years ago, there would be two paramedics on an ambulance going to these emergency calls, which provides us with an ability to not only provide the excellent medical care that's required on critical patients, but have another highly trained paramedic there to manage the logistics of a call, how to get other agencies, all the appropriate communications that need to happen, and with hospitals and other responders and everything else. Due to the continuing decline in reimbursement from all sources, in our area and in many areas of the state, we've had to reduce that to one paramedic and one basic EMT, a significant difference. A basic EMT has just a few weeks of training. Paramedic has a degree and years of training and clinical experience. As we move forward and continue to face funding crises, we don't know where else we can afford to make efficiencies like that change that we've done in the last couple of years to now without dramatically reducing the quality of care we can provide. The only other solution is to have less providers available on the road, which increases significantly the time that's required to get people to a trauma center. As president of the association, we have public members, private members, hospital members, and a volunteer ambulance representative. This is happening all over the state. It's not a coast problem or a valley problem or a southern Oregon problem. It's an Oregon problem, and it needs an Oregon solution, which brings me to the funding mechanism of the PIP and the 911 telephone tax increase. It is effectively a statewide solution to a statewide problem. I'm currently the chairman of the user board of a regional 911 center. I can tell you that House Bill 3394 would have absolutely no impact on our 911 center budget. This is a conduit to move an additional few cents in telephone tax into another part of the system. It's all part of the same system. It's not taking away from one piece and moving it to another. We feel that this is a very effective way to deal with a critical problem in Oregon and urge you to support 3394.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. We'll call up Susan King and Sandy Giffen.
Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm representing the Oregon Nurses Association. I'm an ER nurse by clinical practice. I left the emergency department at 12:30 last night. My evening in the ER last night certainly brought me in contact with the trauma system. Not only do we care for patients who have major traumas and who are needing to be move to the highest level of trauma, which would be the level one trauma centers. But our current trauma system also has a role to play in making sure that the appropriate level of care is achieved and that patients are transported to the appropriate place. The Oregon Nurses Association supports all the provisions of this bill. We believe that this is an important policy for the state to enact. We believe that the public should support adequate trauma care for all of our citizens. I'd like to speak today to two specific issues. You've heard already the testimony about some of the issues around medical specialties, about staffing of the first responders and transport services. But I'd like to talk about the poison center as the first issue and some of the issues related to rural emergency care as the second. Last night in the emergency department where I practice, we had a young man who came in with multiple drug overdose and some pretty unusual drugs that we don't typically encounter in an emergency department. The services of the trauma center are very important, not only to a parent who calls the poison center with a child who has magically opened a bottle that adults can't and ingested all of the contents, as well as those of us who provide emergency care within hospitals. We appreciate and we use very intensively the consultation, the professional consultation, the education, and the follow-up. It is particularly gratifying to me as a nurse that when I am in the process of caring for a patient that has been in contact with the poison center or that we have contacted the poison center about, their follow-through is excellent. We can concentrate our efforts on providing the direct care for the patient. They can do the research on whatever the substance is we're dealing with and make recommendations to us so that our care can be most effective. So I believe that funding the poison center through this mechanism is very, very important for all of the citizens in Oregon. Second, I'd like to briefly mention some issues related to rural trauma care. I practice in Portland, and when I go out to meet with my colleagues in rural hospitals, they often look to me as if I am the expert. However, for any of you who have been in a small rural hospital, sometimes you only have yourself and your own knowledge base. You don't have all of the experts around you as those of us in the Portland area do. When a patient who has been injured in any kind of an accident comes to a rural hospital, there is a presumption, of course, that that patient will be able to be transported should they need a higher quality of care or higher level of care. However, one of my colleagues practices in a small hospital on the coast, and so when the weather conditions are just right, that hospital is isolated both for ground transport in many cases and also for air transport. So what is a small rural hospital and certainly not a level one trauma center rapidly becomes so, and the staff who are there who don't have the access to specialists or to each other must provide care requiring a very broad knowledge base. We support the provisions of this bill because we think if we can avoid some of the cost shifting and we can achieve a greater leveraged federal dollars to provide services both within the pre-hospital setting and in the hospital setting, we can assist the professionals within hospitals in maintaining and upgrading their skills so that when they are confronted with a patient that they cannot transport and they need to provide a higher level of care, they will be able to have the knowledge base and the skills to do so. So, again, the Oregon Nurses Association urges your support for this bill, and we're happy to be a part of it.
Thank you, Susan.
Good morning, representatives. My name is Sandy Giffen, and I'm the department director for the Oregon Poison Center, and would like to speak in support of the amendments that are forthcoming, which would provide some support to the Poison Center through the 911 phone funding mechanism. The Oregon Poison Center was established in 1978 by an act of the Oregon State Legislature, preceding the 1981 legislation that established Oregon's current 911 system. And the Poison Center was housed and has been housed at Oregon Health Sciences University for the past 25 years, and virtually all of our funding is through the university. In light of some of the current financial challenges faced by the university, it is unlikely that the university will continue to be able to subsidize the Poison Center, and that's what brings me here today. Today, there are 51 certified regional poison centers that provide access to the entire U.S. population. They've been designated through federal and state legislation. There's no redundancy, and they all abide by the same standards of care. The poison center system and 911 system are the only single-access nationwide telephone access numbers for emergency medical assistance now. So 911, and there's a single number wherever you are in the country, you are routed to your designated poison center. 24 hours a day, the public as well as healthcare providers contact the Oregon Poison Center for assistance in treating and managing patients that have experienced some type of exposure. As I mentioned before, the Poison Center is the only access to clinical toxicology services in our region. Last year, the Poison Center received 70,000 calls, and 1,500 of those calls were from the EMS system, hazmat teams, paramedics on the scene, and 911 dispatchers. The Poison Center was consulted on 10,000 patients that were in hospitals where healthcare providers needed the assistance of the nurses and physicians at the Poison Center. And all of our service is provided through the phone. Although the service for pediatric accidental poisonings is pretty apparent, and I think the public certainly is very aware of that, the Poison Center deals with a lot of other issues. As Susan mentioned, teens experimenting with everything from over-the-counter cough and cold medications to designer drugs of abuse, ecstasy, date rape drugs, 911 dispatchers who need assistance in knowing the most effective way to dispatch assistance to the scene contact the Poison Center, paramedics on the scene of drug overdose patients call us, a senior citizen who has taken a double dose of their blood pressure medication, a migrant farm worker who's been exposed to a pesticide, hazardous materials teams on the scene of numerous types of chemical spills. We are contacted by the Oregon Emergency Response on all of those cases. Occupational exposures, hikers in Central Oregon with snake bites. In those situations, we know where the antidotes and antivenoms are and facilitate transport of those substances from one healthcare facility to another. And most recently, all of the public emergency response personnel and healthcare providers that are preparing for biochemical terrorism events. Today, case data from the Oregon Poison Center is electronically transmitted every 3 minutes to Washington, D.C., to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, and it is used as part of the United States Operation Liberty Shield for our bioterrorism planning. And poison centers represent the only clinical toxicology expertise for chemical exposures that would occur. A survey of the poison center callers, and I've attached this in the documents that you have, indicate what other resources they would use in the event that the poison center was not there. The results indicate the potential financial impact of nearly $8 million if there were not poison center services. And that is actually also been clarified in a national study that showed that. What would happen is people would end up going to an emergency department to receive treatment, and the details of that is attached in the documents. The incidence of poisoning and toxic exposures is so common that nearly every person in every county in Oregon has used the services of the Poison Center or knows someone who has. Today, with the increased concern about chemical bioterrorism, the need is so great and the potential utilization of this service is so essential that I ask for your assistance in assisting for us to maintain some funding to be able to continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
One quick question. Representative Monica.
How much does it cost to run the Poison Control Center for a year?
Generally, it's about $1.4 million, $1.39 for full operation. Poison Center is actually, because clinical toxicology expertise is very rare, we have seven medical toxicologists on staff, and they have to serve a broad population. It's the most cost-effective. It's not possible to have a medical toxicologist in every community, and particularly for an emergency type of situation where time is critical for us, the first few minutes of a call is essential. So it's been determined to be the most cost-effective way of providing that expertise.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much, ladies. Could we have Gail Shibley and Bill Olson, please?
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Gail Shibley, the Administrator of the Office of Public Health Systems in the Department of Human Services. The department is in support of House Bill 3394, and we believe, particularly during these times of heightened concerns of public safety, public security, that shoring up and stabilizing Oregon's very fragile trauma system is good for all of us and absolutely critical in and of itself. You have heard some of the need for addressing different pieces of the system. I want to highlight just a couple of those, and I also am having the assistant pass out some information of what is the system. You've heard of a trauma system. What really does it consist of? And it really is not only from the time of a particular trauma, assessment and first care along with transportation and stabilization, treatment, and so on, but it is also a statewide network of hospitals. And both parts of those have to work for the system to be stable. Oregon, once again, was a pioneer and was the first state to identify that even small rural hospitals are an absolutely essential part of that integrated trauma system to provide optimal trauma care. And we notice and are very concerned about at the state level that hospitals are reevaluating now their level of commitment to this care and to the trauma system. In addition, physicians, particularly those surgeons, neurosurgeons, and orthopedic surgeons, are limiting their call schedule or otherwise opting out of being a part of this system. Frankly, are less attracted to pursuing a practice in a state with inadequate compensation of care. This equates to a very significant loss of services throughout Oregon, and we believe threatens trauma care and its ability to quite literally save lives. On page 2 of the written testimony, you'll see a chart there that estimates the charges to the Oregon Health Plan and to Medicaid with estimated reimbursement charges that are estimated from extrapolating samples of data that we have received and have been able to collect from each of these categories. And you'll notice that the reimbursement rates average anywhere from as low as 36% for physicians up to about 49% to physicians. But overall, as a state, we are about funding or reimbursing about half of the overall charges. Level 1 hospitals, as you may know, are the two hospitals in the metro area, or two of the hospitals in the metro area. They care for about 50% of the trauma registry patients. They incur more than 3/4 of the trauma system charges. Level 2 hospitals, and those are three facilities, Corvallis, Eugene, and Bend, care for an additional 14% and incur about 14% of the system charges. There are 21 hospitals, level 3, they care for just under a third, and level 4 care for about 6% of them, and also incur costs to transfer severely injured patients to either a level 1 or a level 2 trauma facility for definitive care. In the past, hospitals could and did engage in cost shifting. If they were losing money in the trauma center, they could make it up in other areas of the hospital. That ability to offset decreases by increasing the charges to those with private insurance is much less possible in these days of managed care. At the same time, physicians have never particularly, or surgeons rather, have never particularly been able to engage in that cost shifting. If you're a neurosurgeon, you're a neurosurgeon. Where else are you going to shift that cost to try to make it up? We believe that this bill addresses this issue of undercompensation that erodes the security, the stability, and the reliability of this statewide system. One, as you've heard, by increasing the personal injury protection, and two, by increasing 911 emergency reporting system tax, so that, as a good representative has very eloquently said, when people grab their phone to dial 911, there'll be someone there and something there that they can rely on and literally stake their lives on. We believe that personal injury protection coverage increase does have a logical nexus. 56% of trauma registry patients are involved in motor vehicle-related crashes. and clearly 911 is very much a part of, and using your telephone to dial 911 is also a very logical nexus as well. In sum, I just want to reiterate that although the cost of providing these services continues to rise, reimbursement for the trauma care and funding for the trauma system infrastructure has not risen proportionately. And for the first time in the history of our pioneering trauma system, physicians are opting out of taking trauma call, and hospitals are reassessing their commitment to providing the service. And we believe that if trauma services are not funded adequately and available in an integrated way, will significantly impair the care provided to Oregonians and those in our state. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Bill Olson. I'm a member of the Brain Injury, a board member of the Brain Injury Association of Oregon, and I'm here to speak on behalf of and in support of House Bill 3394. By way of personal information, the mission of the association is to improve the quality of life for people with brain injury and to prevent brain injury, very important part of the mission. As a personal note, my son suffered a brain injury in 1983 when he was skiing from a fall. He was airlifted by helicopter to St. Mary's Trauma Center in Reno. And though he was in a coma, he did survive, which would not have been the case without that regional trauma system response. He has continuing significant cognitive disability, but he is with us, and for that we're very grateful. I've submitted written testimony, and I will not take the time to go through it in detail. I just want to make a couple of key points. Traumatic brain injury is a very significant public health problem that has, I think, been under-recognized. The numbers are fairly persuasive. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention estimates that nationally approximately 5.3 million people, or roughly 2%, a little less than 2% of the total population, is living with this long-term disability as a result of traumatic brain injury. If we apply that statistic to Oregon, it means there could be as many as 65,000 people plus in Oregon that have some disability related to their brain injury. We don't have great prevalence data that we generate here internally, so we have to rely to some degree right now on the CDC estimates. The annual average for the past 7 years shows that we've had approximately 2,900 hospitalizations for traumatic brain injury on an annual basis. Of the causes of brain injury, motor vehicle accident and falls are the two primary causes, accounting for 75% of the total number of traumatic brain injuries. In checking with the Oregon Medical Assistance Plan, for the two-year period, 1999 and 2000, there were a total of 10,900, almost 11,000 individuals that had assistance from OMAP that had a TBI diagnostic code. 55% of those were male and 45% female. Brain injury is a complex problem or issue. It can result in physical, cognitive, and psychosocial and behavioral consequences or impairments in the wake of the brain injury. And some of these consequences do not become apparent until months after the person has left the acute system. Yet it's very difficult to connect with these people once they've left the system and to provide information and support as they disperse into the community. In fact, one of the things we hear most from survivors and family members is, we didn't get the information in the hospital or from the hospital as to what we were facing. We didn't have much of an idea what might happen in the long term. And so our goals for the Brain Injury Association's goals for the trauma system is, first of all, the prevention of brain injury and trauma in the first place. Let's keep that as part of the concept. And be sure that we're focusing on that, minimizing the damage when it does occur so that the outcomes can be better and people have a better chance to achieve independence, return to work, return to their lives. And, of course, connecting survivors of brain injury and other trauma with information and resources to assist them to successfully transition from the hospital setting back to the community or wherever they go from that setting. The amendments that are proposed to HB 3394 that would incorporate certain recommendations of the Governor's Task Force on Brain Injury include the creation of a Brain Injury Commission, the establishment of a TBI registry. Now, the TBI registry would go beyond the trauma registry, which doesn't really cover the entire state, as I understand it, would provide richer data that would enable the analysis of the cause of injury in greater depth than we can now do and allow the development of more effective prevention strategies. Also, the point at which the people are transitioning from the acute care system and the trauma system is a point at which we need to make a connection with them. So that they know that there is information available and that they are connected to it as much as possible to supports that they will need when they leave the system. And the registry, because it has the names of people, can be used to contact them through appropriate protection of confidentiality, of course, to give them an option to access this information. So our reasons basically for supporting the system, it's very important to enhance the speed and appropriateness of the response so that deaths are prevented and the outcome is improved. It will provide us that if we establish a TBI registry, which is proposed by the bill, it will enable us to do work on prevention more effectively. It will also enable us to do outreach to survivors and provide them with information and support, and to do some research as to longer-term outcomes that can then feed back and help us design improved programs to address needs that are out there. I urge your support of the bill, and we'll respond to questions if you have them.
Representative Dalto.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I know we're pressed for time, but Bill, I just want to take this opportunity to thank you for working so hard for the creation of a Traumatic Brain Injury Commission for several sessions now. I appreciate you making that effort. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Folks, we've got 25 minutes. We've got 13 more people on this bill. There's another bill that folks have traveled some distance for that I do want to get to today. I'm going to say at this point in time that we will not get to 3396 or 3439. We will schedule them again for next week. So I'm going to ask the remaining testifiers, seeing how this bill is not going anywhere today, to try to be as concise as they can. Next up is Scott Gallen, Bruce Bishop, and Jim Anderson. And John Powell, because it's all in the same pan. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies, and I'm going to restrict my comments to the PIP portion of the bill that has been discussed only briefly heretofore. I would only say that we do understand that the 911 tax is problematic, and I've tracked my brain along with Representative Bates, and trying to find some other method. And we will continue to do that, of course. But with the PIP portion of the bill, I think it would be good to, first of all, just say what is PIP. And you can in part define it by what it is not. It is not to replace health insurance coverage. It was never designed for that. If it ever became that, obviously automobile insurance would become unaffordable. So PIP is a first-party benefit in your insurance policy that's required in Oregon. Many states do not have a medical coverage that's required to be purchased. Washington State's an example. Their medical coverage or their version of PIP is an optional coverage that a person can buy in addition to their minimum liability limit. So what it is not is a full health insurance policy. Last session, we had a debate over a bill that would have increased all of the coverages in your automobile insurance policy, BI limits, property damage limits, and PIP. And we strongly opposed that bill because about 20% of the people in Multnomah County drive without automobile insurance and about 12% statewide. The reason is cost. And the PIP coverages are going up dramatically along with other medical costs. And it's going to continue to be a problem. A bill is to be capped in this committee today, Keep Alive, that will hopefully help address some of those problems within the PIP coverage. So we decided this time to work with Dr. Bates in another way, and you'll find that on page 2 of the bill. And this specifically addresses the trauma coverage. And it is an attempt to make sure that in the minimum limits of the $10,000 of PIP, that there is an extra $5,000 available only for trauma. And that would keep the cost from burgeoning dramatically from other billings. PIP has a very distinct disadvantage right now. It's one of the last insurance coverages that has no limits in terms of billing. The statute simply says that the auto insurer shall pay reasonable costs of medical care. The problem with that, reasonable is not defined. And if the insurer says that a billing from a provider is unreasonable, it puts our insured in a very awkward position of having to pay the difference. And they're not in a position to understand what is a reasonable medical cost. And again, I hope we can address that issue with this committee before the session's over. So this PIP coverage, again, is designed to keep us from arguing strenuously, as we did last session, against increasing all of these coverages. Add that $5,000 on top of the minimum PIP coverages available only to the trauma system in cases of accidents, because otherwise the trauma center gets put into the basic limits, and then they have to share with other medical providers if the limits are exhausted. Again, we think that this particular proposal is a much better design than last session, and we would recommend this version to you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. We have 6,600 members, hopefully still going up in that category. We support this legislation strongly. We think it is fundamental for the purpose of the state to assure that there is a strong trauma system for individuals to get treatment in cases of tragedy in some instances. And the evidence is clear that, one, an effective trauma system saves lives in the state of Oregon and elsewhere. But it's also obvious from the evidence today that that system is very fragile, as it is underfunded. substantially underfunded under the current process, and that's due to a variety of things, which I think you've also heard. Some of it has to do with Medicaid funding and other funding sources that have not kept pace with the costs of providing these services. And I cannot emphasize enough how we have attempted to find revenue sources that have a connection to this system in what we understand to be a very difficult legislative session on funding resource areas. In our best analysis, this really is the most logical and reasonable way to go with the broadest base of support, because this really is a system for all Oregonians and should be borne, those costs should hopefully be borne on the widest base possible. We most certainly would be willing to consider alternative approaches if members of the committee or others have suggestions of what that might be. I would imagine that they would also carry with them other concerns or objections, possibly, depending on what they were. But this is, again, kind of a piece of a series of what I believe to be attempts to address a medical infrastructure that is disintegrating in this state, I think, before our very eyes. And I know there are difficult decisions, particularly when it comes to funding issues, but sometimes you have to make those difficult decisions because it will, in fact, benefit a substantial number of those that you represent. I also submitted on behalf of the Hospital Association, Mr. Bishop's testimony. I don't look anything like Bruce. I'd be the very thin version. But the Hospital Association strongly supports this legislation. Orthopedists support this legislation. It is really, I think, one of those issues that this committee can address and should address, and would encourage you to refer the bill. There's a subsequent referral on this legislation to refer this bill to Ways and Means so we can continue the process to try to find a funding source to make sure that this infrastructure does not continue to disintegrate. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Anderson, representing Oregon Chapter of the American College of Emergency Physicians. We, too, support this House Bill 3394, and you've heard all the arguments in support of the bill. I will not belabor it. You have my written testimony before you. Just suffice to say that we do support the bill and the amendments that you will see in the very near future. That includes funding for the trauma centers, the poison control center, and the traumatic brain injury commission. I would also like to state that I was informed this morning that you can add to the list of supporters for this bill the Oregon Association of Orthopedists. With that, Mr. Chair, the three of us stand ready for questions.
Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Brent Wolf, Shelley Jensen, Jimmy Lang, Elsie Brown, and Richard Kosasan.
How many did you call? Five?
Mm-hmm.
You need another chair.
Five people, three chairs should be easy enough to do. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brant Wolf, representing the Oregon Telecommunications Association. You have my written testimony. Just briefly, a couple of points I wanted to make. The OTA is opposed to House Bill 3394 as it relates to the increase in the 911 surcharge, as you might imagine. The OTA, we firmly believe that the 911 surcharge and fund should be dedicated to the purpose of the maintaining the viability of an emergency communications system. Something when people dial 911, they expect to have emergency services dispatching them, fire, police, ambulance, whatever. The local phone service providers that we represent throughout the state collect this fee in good faith from their customers that it's going to go to the 911 fund and be used for that purpose. And we oppose and urge you to oppose as well any effort to increase that fee and then divert it for something other than 911 related activities. The other point, I included with my testimony a copy of the OTA telephone bill for this month. And the point I want to make is that it's difficult to argue against 25 cents. It's only a quarter. Anybody can dig in and find 2 bits. It's not that big of a deal. Taken alone, that's absolutely true. But in the aggregate, and that's why I handed out my telephone bill to you, it is a big deal. It's $58 this month. And I'm not going to go through all these things. You can see them all there yourself. And I think sometimes customers, end users, have difficulty distinguishing between the tax and the phone bill. And frequently the tax increase is seen as a phone rate increase, and somehow the telephone companies are behind this, and we get the phone calls, and why are my rates up, and on and on and on. And that's the final point I wanted to make. I know we're short on time here, and you have my written testimony, you have my telephone bill. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Yeah, who did you call in Beaverton on February 20th?
Probably Shelley.
Okay. Go ahead, Shelley.
Chairman, committee members, for the record, my name is Shelley Jensen. I'm the Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon, and my office is in Beaverton, so probably me. I don't have a lot to add to what Brant's already said. I do want to emphasize that we are not by any means opposed to trauma centers or funding the trauma system. It's simply that we don't think that adding on to the 911 fund is an appropriate way to do it. And part of that reason is because it would be a change in policy. I mean, today the 911 fund pays for the people to answer the 911 calls and to dispatch the services. It does not pay for the provision of any of those services. It doesn't pay for police, fire, any of that kind of thing. So this would be a change in terms of now starting to use that money to pay for the actual services, not just the answering and the dispatching of those. I would also be happy to answer any questions if anybody has any.
Jenny?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jenny Lang. I represent Quest. A couple of additional points. Over the years, there have been a number of efforts to use the telephone lines to fund any number of laudable programs, everything from transportation project packages to poison control in the past. And as Brant has mentioned to you, if you look at that telephone bill, there are already a number of other things that we collect money from our customers to pay for that have to do with low-income subsidies for telephone service, equipment, and programs for the hearing impaired, and a number of other services. Taken in total, these represent over 20% of the average telephone bill. And while it is not a huge cost to the companies to collect that money and remit it to the Department of Revenue for distribution, the cost on our business representatives for managing the irate phone calls that come into our offices when some of these taxes are in fact increased or levied for the first time is pretty dramatic. So I would also echo Shelley's concern about the policy change, and I would remind you that since 9/11 there has been increasing pressure on the 911 providers to get equipment that is more interoperable, that is better able to manage emergency systems, emergency crises of whatever kind of matter, whether it be a natural disaster or terrorism. And the legislature has already begun to erode the amount of money that's available for 911 systems to provide those kinds of basic communications devices and equipment. So we would think that this is a very dramatic policy shift and would urge you not to do this at this time. Thank you.
Any questions? Representative Dalto.
Just really briefly, Ginny, what is the percentage of Oregonians, the number of Oregonians that have phone service? Do you have a sense of that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dalto, I believe it's somewhere in the 95-96% range.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, one more thing.
Yes.
I handed out the Sprint's written testimony. They're not able to be here. So
thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elise Brown, representing AT&T, and I join my colleagues in opposition of House Bill 3394. One other point to hit home again is that our customers have come to expect and believe that that 75 cents surcharge that they see on their bill every month is used for just what it says it is, and that's basic 911 services. If we tell our taxpayers and customers that they're paying for something other than what it says, we're going to break faith with the taxpayers. And breaking faith with taxpayers is going to create greater problems as you all attempt to address the future revenue needs of the state. So I ask you, please, don't break the faith of the taxpayers and vote no on 3394. Thank you.
Richard.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Richard Kosasan, Verizon Wireless. It appears that most of the discussion this morning has centered on the attributes of the trauma program and the need for additional dollars. I think that is a separate policy issue. It really does not tie with a tax increase on a phone bill. I think one of the speakers, I don't want to misspeak, but I think one of the previous individuals indicated that the 911 program today is currently facing inadequate funding. And I would remind the committee members that during one of the special sessions in 2002, in search of additional dollars, in need of additional dollars, $9 million was removed from that fund. So that could play a part in terms of reaching an inadequate funding situation. It is, if you look at the tax, it's rather substantial. I have a very small business. I have four lines there, a line at home, and a wireless line. So once you add those dollars up, my 911 charge for a year would extend from $54 a year to $72. It's not insignificant whatsoever. I don't believe there is the direct nexus between a 911 tax and the trauma funding. I hope that the two are segregated, and thank you very much.
Thank you all. Hasina, Christy, and Larry.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires here today on behalf of the Oregon APCO NENA, which is the Association of Public Safety Communications Officers and the Oregon Chapter of the National Emergency Number Association. In addition, I'm here today representing the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, which represents approximately 300 of the rural fire protection district's elected officials in the state of Oregon today. In opposition to House Bill 3394, I'll be very brief. Representative Bates contacted us and our constituency long in advance of filing this bill, and we just agreed to respectfully disagree on the funding source for this mechanism, for this very important legislation. I do not want to belittle Oregon Poison Control or their emergency trauma system. I would just echo the comments of the wireless community when it comes to the tax and the purity of the tax, and I would also like to point out a few things to this committee with respect to the tax. There's no guarantee that if actually 25 cents were added to this 911 tax for this purpose, that it would actually get to that purpose. Two times this legislature has acted to divert existing 911 revenue to other programs, so they may end up in the same situation as we find ourselves in. In addition, the existing 911 tax provides approximately 20% of each, on average, of each call center's funding for 911 purposes. If you wanted to fund 911 100% with the tax, you'd need to charge about $3.50. While some of the programs proposed in House Bill 3394 are very important programs, I would also point out to you that none of the fire districts receive any of the 911 tax. They pay for their 911 services, and those emergency responders pay to my colleagues to the right fees to the 911 dispatch centers. I also would like to echo Mr. Kosasan's comments on the cell phone location technology, which has not been implemented in this state. There is a federal FCC mandate to provide automatic call locate for wireless technology. It's called Phase 2 Wireless. It has not been implemented, and we are working on doing that. It's a very important program. I understand that these emergency responders want to be able to respond when people call 911 and pick up the phone and want some service, but if we can't find them, we probably aren't going to get to them. With that, I'll just turn it over to my colleagues to the right with me today.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Christy Wild. I'm the manager of Central Lane Communications in Eugene and also immediate past president of Oregon APCO NENA, and I'm here to oppose this bill. As Representative Bates pointed out when we first started this morning, the controversy is with the nexus of the tax. The 911 tax was established for emergency telephone reporting system, answering the call, getting the information out. And until recently, all of the money went for that purpose. I know that you are aware that we are already dealing with a major controversy around appropriate use of 911 money. There has been a trend to cut money available for the service, and there have been service impacts. We support funding an alternate means of trauma services, and we believe that any tax collected for trauma services should be clearly labeled and supported as that. But we don't believe that this is the policy direction in attaching trauma services to the 911 tax, which has been pure for that purpose. I'd be more than willing to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Larry Hatch. I'm the assistant director of the Washington County 911 Center. I would just say ditto to what my colleagues have said here. I applaud Representative Bates' identification of this issue and wanting to seek the funding for it. But if we need new funding, we need new tax dollars, then let's identify them as that, and and they should not be coming out of a tax that I think my constituents firmly believe go to their dispatch center in support of 911.
Thank you all very much. Colleagues, the chair is absolutely in total support of this bill, except for the funding source. It has been suggested that we send this to Ways and Means and let that decision be made down there. The chair is not comfortable with that. We don't make funding decisions, but the source is an integral part of this bill, and it's my intention to hang on to the bill and see if we can find an alternative way to do this. And so this issue is not going away. It's just that we have more work to do. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on 3394 and open the public hearing on 3378. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3378 is requiring carriers that offer individual or group health benefit plans to offer employers that provide those health reimbursement arrangements for major medical expense coverage with specified deductibles. And it also defines health reimbursement arrangements.
Okay. Colleagues, this is a relatively new concept, and I think it's worth our attention. Mike, come on up. And where'd that gallant guy go? You can handle it. You don't need him. Good morning.
Good morning, sir. Chairman Cruz, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. My name is Mike Bond. My current position is Chief Executive Officer of Prime Care, based in Medford, Oregon. for your information, I have held prior positions as senior staff of the National Institutes of Health, Health Programs Director for the U.S. Department of Transportation and the Airline Pilots Association, and a senior executive for a 310,000-member health plan in Colorado. The good news is I am not here to ask you for any money, new taxes or fees, but simply to enact the provisions of a bill that, in essence, would level the playing field for Oregon employers to be able to take advantage of a new type of health benefit program recently authorized by the Internal Revenue Service. I have provided testimony for your information. With your indulgence, perhaps it would be more helpful to spend just a few minutes on the background of what this is and how it might affect the good citizens of the state of Oregon, and then serve at your pleasure, whether it be questions or background information. On June 26th of 2002, the Internal Revenue Service, in a very simple two-page notice, Rule 2002-41, created an entirely new type of health benefit program for employers. This is referred to as a health reimbursement arrangement, and it is similar in structure to the medical savings account and the cafeteria plan flexible spending account, but without either the loss of fund balances at year end of the flexible spending account or the extensive reporting and administrative costs of the medical savings account. Simply put, what the health reimbursement arrangement is a fund that is created and funded by the employer, held in the name of the employee, that may be used for the reimbursement of any tax-deductible health care expenditure. What it offers to the employee is, in essence, a totally individualized health plan. The employee can spend these funds for their medical expenses, the spouse, their dependents, with no regard to insurance plan rules, deductibles, co-insurances, co-payments, or any of the things now that prevent people from getting the care that they feel is appropriate to meet their medical needs. From the standpoint of the employer, and what this offers is not only stability in funding the program, but predictability of the increases in program costs from year to year. In Southern Oregon, and I suspect in most of Oregon, we do not have employers, large multinational employers that retain benefit consulting firms and third-party administrators and benefit consultants. We have employers who are medium and small in size and who generally have one health plan offering for their employees. To give you an example, I dealt with a timber company in Medford, a family-owned company that has been in business in Southern Oregon for 49 years, a year ago today. These people exist in what people in the industry refer to as underwriting no man's land. They are large enough to be experience rated, but small enough that one or two catastrophic cases can put them out of the realm of insurability. In this case, the employer had about 75 eligible employees for a total of about 123 covered lives in their insurance plan. literally at the very end of their insurance contract year. They had a bicycle accident and a heart attack and received a 259% rate increase with 21 days notice. They called us for help, and there was nothing we could do for them. With the HRA, they would have an option, and that would be to create a fund for their employees to the limits of their ability to afford. Now, I think there are, because of the simplicity of the IRS ruling, there are a tremendous number of questions that need to be answered in the structuring of this program. I do not believe that it would be ethical for an employer to simply say, we're going to do away with everything, put $100 a month into an account, and then you're on your own. That has been a concern that has been raised. I can only point out that there is no statutory requirement now for an employer to provide health insurance outside of a collective bargaining agreement, and I do not believe Oregon employers would follow that course of action. In fact, what we see as the probable structure would be the creation of the HRA account wrapped with a major medical coverage to protect people from catastrophic exposure. In fact, the two purposes of providing employee health benefits since their inception have been to attract and retain the most qualified people and to protect them against catastrophic loss. What the creation of the HRA does, in essence, is take us out of the realm of prepaid health benefit plans, which is what we have now, and to put us back into the realm of true insurance coverage against major financial loss, while providing the employee a discretionary fund that they may use to their advantage and to meet their individual needs. As Representative Cruz mentioned, this is a new concept. It has only been available since June the 26th of last year. And I can tell you that the types of employers who have adopted these already, Charter Communications, Budget Rent-A-Car, the Principal Financial Group, Raytheon, Intel, Textron, Medtronic, Ridgeview Hospital Corporation, etc. As you see, these are all very large employers that have a self-funded plan. To create the HRA, they need only to fund the account and to adjust their reinsurance amounts, because the employer is the insuring entity. In order to make this product available to employers in Oregon, the rationale behind the bill, and I thank Representative Patridge for his sponsorship of this, was twofold. First, to try and make the major medical coverage available in the state of Oregon reasonably priced, and thereby to generate savings that can be used for the employer to fund the HRA. And secondly, to have our insurers offer major medical coverage, pardon me, with deductible amounts that once again blend with the HRA to create what most people believe is a significant advantage to the employee, not a takeaway. In sum, this is a way we can improve the benefits available to our employees, provide some stability in pricing to our employers. I believe, and we have certainly seen in Southern Oregon with a number of our smaller employers that are simply dropping coverage because they cannot afford it any longer. Save jobs in Oregon. It is certainly too early to tell what the long-term outcome of this concept will be. I would close with two things. One, Harry Becker, who is the general counsel for the IRS, and I have talked quite a bit about this concept. And I asked him once, I said, Harry, the IRS is not exactly known for its socially progressive rulemaking. What's this all about? He said to me quite simply, Mike, we realized that if we were ever to rein in out-of-control health costs, we were going to have to at least create the perception that the patient was spending their own money. That is entirely what is behind this. What comes about? We have some first-year studies by companies who have implemented them. The perception on the part of employees is an increase in benefits available. and a decrease of approximately 11% in total medical costs. I would point out to you all, the lowest percentage decrease in all areas of benefits is in the receipt of preventive medical care. I believe that making this option available for Oregon employers is a way that we can put people back in control of their own health spending, increase the financial solvency of many of our Oregon employers, and in essence create a win for everybody in the equation. And that's why I have brought it to you. Thank you.
Scott.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. Mr. Bond presented this legislation to us, which I have had an initial review from our legislative committee, and we've sent it on to our council for review. Generally, the association, while we have not finalized our analysis on this bill, we believe this bill has real merit. The fundamental issue is that you would actually reduce the cost of premiums for employers in purchasing their health care benefits. It's a net effect of this. And unlike the current structure, I hold back pre-tax funds personally, for example. And if I don't use those funds, then those monies are gone. This would enable me, in fact, to roll funds over and continue to be able to use them for costs, deductibles, et cetera, in the future for me and my family. So what I essentially have to do as an individual in contemplating what I may withhold from my salary is guess what kind of medical expenses I may incur in the future. And while sometimes I think I'm really bright, most of the time I don't. It's real hard to figure out what may happen in the future on something in this arena. And I can assure you that I have had a varying success rates on whether or not my guesses were correct on the amount of funds that I should withhold. So there are some real advantages, I believe, in this bill. It does clearly state that these funds would be paid solely by the employer and not provided pursuant to a salary reduction, which is not something to gloss over. But there is really a real benefit to the employer, because I can assure you, under another program that the Medical Association is doing for our own employees, we have a employer fund that is paying 90% of our deductible. We raise the amount that we all have to deal with. The association reimburses the employees up to a certain amount. We still have our own individual responsibility, which is appropriate. But it's reduced our increased premium costs substantially from what they would have been this year. So this bill, I think, as a matter of policy, really deserves your serious consideration. And I will obviously provide you with our council's analysis once I get it, which I hope is soon in the near future. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Representative Cruz, if I might add one final thing, and pardon me for contradicting myself when I said I was finished. One might ask why a physician-based organization would be in support of this concept. In my testimony to you all, I've made the comment that there is not economic gain to the physicians from this, and that is very true. We do perceive, however, significant improvements in the patient-physician relationship, from being able to interact directly with the patient without an awful lot of rules and restrictions and co-insurances and co-payments in between. But even more importantly, I do come to you today, and I apologize. I'm not terribly sophisticated at the legislative process, or I probably would have built my house better before I brought it to you for inspection. But with a very high level of interest on the part of virtually every school district, every municipality, the Rogue Valley Council of Governments, Medford Fabrication, our TV stations, our media, because they see in this not price savings, but price stability into the future. None of those 259% rate increases. In the case of my own business, by my calculation, we had $2,122 in claims paid by our insurance policy last year. We just received a 30% rate increase. But even beyond that, one of the things that our physicians all hear in this, and this I did not emphasize enough in the structure of this program, the balances in the health reimbursement account may be carried forward tax-free from year to year into retirement. One of the first things that my physicians hear in this premise is the idea that we all know when we read the predictions about when Medicare is going to be either insolvent or in trouble. And one of the things that the doctors hear is this is a possibility for a person who spends these funds wisely to build a significant account balance to protect them in their Medicare years. I will stop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief question. If this is really a health reimbursement, where does the account balance build up? Or is it a payment each month by the employer to the employee for reimbursement?
That is not specified by the Internal Revenue Service, but I think strictly from a fiduciary responsibility, the employer would make a monthly contribution to the employee's account, either in cash or in the form of a credit. And certainly with all of the privacy and medical confidentiality regulations that we all deal with under the HIPAA regulations these days, in all probability this would be administered by either the insurance company carrying the major medical coverage or a third-party administrator.
Okay, follow up. And you said that the balance does accrue to the employee, not to the employer.
Absolutely. It is the employee's property by law.
Thank you.
Any questions? Gentlemen, thank you. Thank you for coming up, Mike.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. Cindy and John.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I represent Pacific Source Health Plans, which is based in Eugene. I have to commend Mr. Bond and his physicians group for seeing the value in these health reimbursement arrangements. They are going to be a good thing. I think they're going to be a thing of the future, and I think a lot of people will take advantage of them. And I also think a lot of health carriers will start to sell them. It's not necessary, however, for this to be legislated. Pacific Source Health Plans is working on our health arrangements, health reimbursement arrangement plans this very moment. We're hoping to roll out by the end of the month. We are even thinking that even though we're one of the smaller insurers in Oregon, that we may be the first person to offer this product, which thrills us. However, I think that the industry will come together and compete with each other with these products and that there's no need to require it through statute. On top of that, I have concerns that within the statute, you begin to limit what can be offered to the employer. In this bill specifically, the deductible has to be at least $3,000 per individual and $5,000 per family. Our health reimbursement arrangement plan that we're currently working on has a deductible of just $2,500. So it's probably a better plan, or at least a more lenient plan, and we'd like to continue to have those kind of options as we try to meet the needs of employers and employees in choosing their health care. So those kind of restrictions are not things that we'd like to see. We'd like to see the employees and the employers help to establish the market and what the need is, and we'd like to have the health insurance carriers determine who's going to offer it and how we're going to compete with each other. That's the way the best products are developed, not necessarily through legislation.
John.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Powell representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Mr. Chairman, members, we do not believe this bill is necessary. The Internal Revenue Code has established the outlines, as the previous witness has indicated. The products are being developed currently by insurance companies. There is a bill that's going to, I'm sure, pass the Senate that requires insurance companies to offer high deductible plans. That bill is being pushed by those who support medical savings accounts. And the federal law is different in the MSA arrangement as opposed to the HRA arrangement. And I'm saying that using those acronyms only for my benefit, so someday I may remember what they mean. But I don't think this bill is necessary, and as Cindy has pointed out, the reference to specific deductible amounts I don't think is necessary. If a company like Pacific Source has a $2,500 policy, you're saying, well, what's wrong with having a $3,500 or a $3,000 deductible as well? Well, that does add to your administrative costs and how you, if the more plans you have out with different benefit levels, costs you more to process and that sort of thing. Finally, I would just point to out subsection 3 of section 2, which I believe allows the development of health benefit plans without state mandates. And I'm sure that would be extremely controversial, not that I'm here opposing that. I just wanted to point that out for the committee so you would not be blindsided. I do think that that section would allow for that.
Questions? Thank you very much. The chair is very intrigued by this concept. We're going to keep working on it. Whether or not legislation is necessary, we will find when we get to the end of that road. Thank you very much. Well, please come up. You got to come up and state your name for the record again and do all those good things, Mike.
Thank you very much.
Michael Bond again. In my testimony to the committee, please note the second paragraph, which is a clarification of the language in the current bill for an act, because that provision about the amount of deductibles, apparently my language was not clear and it was misinterpreted by several people. I have clarified that to say that major medical products with deductibles of up to at least $3,000 and $5,000 would be made available. So if an insurance company wishes to offer a plan with a $2,500 deductible or a $10,000 deductible, or the employer wishes to purchase a different level, they would certainly be able to.
Okay. Thank you, Mike. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3378. And I'm going to open public hearing on 2842. Close public hearing 2842. Open public hearing 2888. Close public hearing 2888. Open public hearing 3286. Close public hearing 3286. Open public hearing 3570. Close public hearing 3570. Open the public hearing 3411. Close public hearing 3411. We're adjourned.
Okay.